Hello there, and welcome back to In the Shadows of Utopia. Before we continue, I'm going to provide you something like the preface to the book here. This is the podcast preface. If you've landed here after the introductory episode to the show, where I laid out, in the most basic way possible, the culmination of events that much of this series will focus on explaining, you'll already know that the story of the Khmer Rouge does not begin in 1975. In fact, exactly where that story begins can be a little hard to pin down. Because, and I can say this from the experience of years of actually setting this series out, the moment you start to try and explain how the Khmer Rouge came to power, you immediately run into a problem. You can't explain their murderous revolution without explaining the Cambodian Civil War. You can't explain the Cambodian Civil War or why there is American, Chinese, or Vietnamese involvement in it without explaining the history of the war that had been unfolding next door in Vietnam since the early 1960s. But once you try to explain that conflict properly, you're pushed further back again into the war that ended French colonial rule in the region. And then once you find yourself having to explain the concept of French Indochina, well, you have to deal with the major forces that shaped much of the 20th century. Nationalism, communism, revolution, and how those ideas travelled between Southeast Asia and places like Paris, Beijing, Washington, and Moscow. And then another question presents itself. How do you explain why Cambodia entered the 20th century in such a vulnerable position in the first place? And to answer that, you have to look back a long time before the French arrived, to the long centuries when the Cambodian kingdom survived in the shadow of more powerful neighbours, squeezed between Vietnam to the east and Siam, Thailand, to the west. This was a traumatic period that left a deep imprint on Cambodian political culture, and on how Cambodians came to understand their place in the region and world. And once you get there, you're actually dealing with the aftermath of something much older, the end of the period where the medieval Khmer city of Angkor was the centre of power for Cambodia, and indeed for much of the Southeast Asian mainland. A Khmer empire, with a capital city that rivaled any in the pre-industrial world, in terms of scale, engineering, and artistry. So, almost without trying, if you follow that chain honestly, you end up back at the beginning of Cambodian history. And you know what? That's actually pretty neat, because for those of you listening that want to know the whole story, not just the murderous details of the 1970s, but actually finding out why that tragedy happened, well, this show is for you. This is not a surface-level account. This show is about building enough depth and context to really understand how and why the Khmer Rouge Revolution occurred. Because it's not monocausal, it's not simple, it's not a straight line of dominoes falling in a row. Explaining Cambodian history and the rise of the Khmer Rouge involves following about six separate and converging lines of dominoes falling over each other at once. And it just so happens that explaining this history from start to finish mirrors the way that most people, whether they encounter Cambodia as visitors or experience its history from within, actually physically access this story through two dominant portals that Cambodian history is usually understood through. And I mean that. Visitors, locals, they really do walk through these portals into history in the country. The first is in Phnom Penh, the modern capital. Stepping through the gates of S21, the former high school turned into a torture prison by the Khmer Rouge, or walking through Chong Ek, the killing field where more than 10,000 of its inmates were taken away to. This portal is Cambodia's recent, tragic past, and it produces a feeling of overwhelming sadness. You're confronted with the scale of the violence that occurred beneath your feet, as well as with the fact that this horror was carried out methodically across the whole country. The trauma it produced is impossible to comprehend, and you're left mostly with questions about how humans can do this to each other. Now, that historical portal into the 1970s is, almost literally, a pit of misery dug into the ground. But the other portal into Cambodia's past takes you much further back, around 1,000 years, to what could be described as the high watermark of the Khmer civilization, the remnants of the country's medieval capital, what we refer to today as Angkor, near the northwestern city of Siem Reap. This region presents wonders of the world, astonishing architecture, art, and design that has stood the test of time, or been reclaimed by the verdant countryside around its modern ruins. These echoes of a Khmer civilization overwhelm in a very different way, with abounding beauty, awe, and amazement as you walk through them. The questions of how this wondrous past was built and how Cambodia ended up with such a tragedy in its modern times becomes apparent. So if you visit these sites, you're confronted with two very different eras of Cambodian history, but they are connected. But we don't want to fall into the trap of drawing large, sweeping conclusions. From golden age to despotism and genocide, from regional power to colonial asset, from one of the great civilizations of the pre-industrial world to one of the great tragedies of modern history. Those stories are compelling, the stories of kings, hubris, civilizations rising and falling, but they are simplistic narratives imposed on a far more complicated, uneven, and non-linear past. That being said, historians constructing an explanation of the Khmer Rouge have often invoked some reference to Angkor, and that is almost unavoidable as ideas about Cambodia's glorious past were very important to the Khmer Rouge. However, not in the way that many people seem to think. There is a bit of a myth about the Khmer Rouge, that they were trying to return Cambodia to its ancient origins, as in literally recreate a primitive society again, usually given with some reference to the idea of Year Zero. But people are missing the point here, because their revolution was not about going backwards and staying there at all. It was actually about propelling the country forward into a new period of greatness, the greatest socialist revolution that the world had ever seen, according to them. Not going backwards. In fact, they never even used the phrase Year Zero, like is commonly thought. But still, Cambodia's glorious past was a reference point to the architects of that revolution. So when Pol Pot declared in 1977 that if the Cambodian people could build Angkor, they could do anything, or when the national anthem of Democratic Kampuchea proclaimed that the victory of 17th of April 1975 was more glorious, more meaningful than the Angkor era itself, well, this meant a lot. The iconoclasts of the Khmer Rouge, creating a new revolutionary society, still felt it was necessary to put Angkor Wat on their new flag. Because a very particular idea of Cambodia's history, and of Angkor in particular, had loomed large in the imagination of the Cambodian communists, just as it had for the politicians and rulers of Cambodia before they took power, and just as it still does today. Because Cambodia is almost synonymous with the temples of Angkor. So if we want to understand how the Cambodian communists viewed their country, we need to understand what the country is, what Angkor was, why it mattered, and how its legacy endured long after the city itself ceased to be the centre of power. And to do all of that, we need to go right back to the very start. And that is what these three new episodes are for. Now, before we go any further, I should briefly note that this is a re-recording. Or more than that, this is a whole redo. The original versions of Part 1 and Part 2 were released way back in 2018. I'm revisiting them and completely redoing them now and adding a third for a couple of reasons. The first is just practical. Over the years, the scope of this project has expanded enormously, and with that has come a clearer sense of how best to tell this story. I've learned a lot about how to produce a podcast over the last 8 years, and because of how deep this story goes, I just wanted the beginning to highlight the quality of the rest of the series. While the second is historical. Scholarship on Angkor and early Cambodian history has been changing in important ways, and some ideas that were once treated as completely settled have been revised. And because this series has become a starting point about Cambodian history for such a wide audience, I felt that I have a responsibility to go back and update this foundation, from big things to small things. I mean, in one instance, the Australian ambassador to Cambodia got in touch to tell me about the mispronunciation of a 13th century visitor to Angkor, and you know, something like that can kind of bug me when I'm trying to get to sleep. So I wanted a redo. And these episodes matter because they set up more or less everything. And I want you to have the best impression of the show from an early point. So we got to do them properly. Now, in a very broad sense, the aim with this whole podcast has always been to be able to take someone who knows literally nothing about this history and gradually build up all the tools and information they need to understand it at a really high level, while still offering something new to those who are pretty well versed in the terrain. I've had people get in contact that didn't know anything about the country but ended up visiting based on the podcast, and others who have wrote books on the subject who wanted to get in touch and say they'd learned something. So that's a big deal for me to try and treat both of those audiences. And like I've said, I've learned so much about this subject over the last decade, and I wanted to pour that back into this. And just one last reason, and this might concern you, my dear listener, is that I think these first two episodes in particular are extremely helpful for those people who are going to visit the country and Angkor itself. So I've had people get in touch about that, and I want to make this as informative as possible. More like an audiobook than a podcast, I want you to have the basics in place before you go to Angkor, because I know that when I first went, I think when I was 20 years old, I didn't know anything. And on subsequent visits, the more you know, the more you appreciate just how special that place is. I want the country to come alive, that little bit extra for people who do get to visit. And I hear that it does help with that. So I just wanted to make these Angkor episodes even better. And because of that, I have made some pretty big changes, and I do have one suggestion for you. If you'd prefer a visual version of this Angkor three-part series, you can find this on YouTube. I've tried to make this very engaging. I'm present throughout. I explain a few things a little differently, and the history is tied to amazing visuals that I've collected myself and from a few other contributors. I don't think it's going too far to say that this is the most historically accurate YouTube documentary about early Cambodian history, the Angkorian period, and its decline out there. And it picks up immediately after this introduction that I'm saying right now. So if you want to watch these three episodes instead of just listen, it's very easy, and you just follow the link at the top of the episode description below. That will take you to YouTube and episode one. Don't forget to watch all three, obviously, and I don't know, check out my other videos, like just how accurate is the Killing Fields movie when you're done. If you're more of a watcher, go ahead and do that now. Literally, use your thumbs, use your mouse, go down in the description, I will wait a few seconds for you. Last chance to click that link in the description, watch it in all its Technicolor glory. No? Not a visuals kind of person? Good for you, all right. Totally fine. Stay here and listen on, my dear listener. In part one, we're going to lay the groundwork. We'll ask some very basic questions. Who are the Khmer? What kind of land is Cambodia? How did that shape the belief of their world? How did power, religion, agriculture, and kingship come together in a way that eventually produced the civilization centered at Angkor? Who was the first king of the Khmer Empire? Part 2 will then follow that civilization established in the 9th century to its zenith, over 500 years of an empire that reached over all of mainland Southeast Asia, and how it produced such magnificence, and the deeds of its many great kings, the wars they fought. You will know who built Angkor, Angkor Wat, Angkor Thom, how the skeleton we see there today was constructed, and just how incredible these feats were. In part 3, we will leave the stories of kings behind and try and experience Angkor, this capital of the Khmer Empire, firsthand. We will learn how it functioned through the story of the one person who wrote a book about his visit to the city more than 700 years ago. And you will walk through the city with him, learn how the people lived, how the city felt for those 750,000 people who called it home at its height. And you will also learn how it didn't collapse. The Khmer Empire didn't just fall. you will learn how and why it transformed over time. Indeed, how Angkor Wat was never lost. So with that said, let's begin at the beginning. What is Cambodia, and who are the Khmer? If we start at the beginning, in the many stories Cambodians tell about themselves, the land they now inhabit was always alive. This is the mythology of how their world came into being. They speak of a landscape that's unstable, covered by water. Beneath the surface live the Nagas, great serpents like giant cobras, associated with water, rain, fertility, and the hidden power of the earth. They are guardians between water and land, between the human realm and the spirit world. Without them, nothing grows or lasts. Into this world came a man from elsewhere. There are many versions of this story. In some, he's a prince. In others, a Brahmin, a learned religious figure from the West. Sometimes he's simply an outsider arriving by sea, carrying knowledge and ambition. In later accounts, he's named Kondinya. Where he comes from matters less than what he does when he arrives in this legend. He encounters the daughter of the Naga king, a woman who belongs both to the human world and to the world beneath the water. In popular stories, she is called Niang Nyak. In more formal accounts, she is known as Soma, a name associated with the moon. To marry her, he must follow her beneath the water into her father's realm, and that's where their marriage takes place. Only after this union does the world above begin to change. The Naga king causes the waters to recede, revealing land where people can settle, plant rice, and build a kingdom. This pattern survives in Khmer folklore, where the couple are remembered as Prea Thong and Niang Nyak. Even today, Cambodian wedding ceremonies echo this union between human society and the spirits of the land. But alongside this version of the story is another beginning, told differently. In this one, a hermit named Kambu, a figure associated with ritual power, is given a wife by the god Shiva, a celestial woman named Mera. From their union comes a royal lineage, the people themselves, and even the name of the land. From Kambu comes Kambuja, the land of Kambu, a name that passes through languages and centuries before becoming Cambodia. But before we turn to the people who told this story, we have to understand the place that they lived in. The deep history of Cambodia doesn't quite map onto the country you see on the map today. The people who lived here over thousands of years existed within a much larger world, the Lower Mekong Basin, and the borders we see now are very recent. They cut through a landscape that was once connected. So when we talk about the Khmer world, we're really talking about modern Cambodia, but also parts of northeastern Thailand, the Mekong Delta in what is now southern Vietnam, and areas of Laos. At the center of it all is the Mekong River. It starts thousands of kilometers away on the Tibetan Plateau, runs down through China, cuts through mountain ranges, and by the time it reaches Cambodia, it has changed character entirely. It's no longer one channel moving in one direction, it spreads out through tributaries and distributaries, less like a highway and more like a circulatory system, pushing water and sediment and life out across the land. And because Cambodia itself is extremely flat, a broad, low plain shaped almost like a shallow bowl, all of that water has nowhere to rush. It pools, spreads, and drains slowly. The combination of a massive river system and a landscape that holds water is what sets everything else up. And the other thing that governs life here is the monsoon. For roughly half the year, it rains hard and consistently. The land saturates, rivers overflow, water spreads across the plain. Then the rains stop almost entirely, and the same ground that was underwater bakes in the sun. Half the year too wet, half the year too dry. This too wet, then too dry system, that is the central challenge to the people who live in this area. Thousands of years ago, right through to the present day. But that isn't to say that the entire country is completely flat or dominated by this system. In the border areas and throughout, there are a few mountain ranges, scattered, isolated hills, and they stand out in this landscape. They're known as Phnom. Phnom Penh, the modern capital, has a small hill adorned with a temple, which is where it gets its name from. It's a phrase you will see a lot in Cambodia and in this series, because they're important places, practically and spiritually. But aside from the hills, there are some mountains. To the north and northwest, along the modern-day border with Thailand, you have the Dangreks, while to the southwest, the Cardamom and Elephant Mountains form a barrier between the low basin of the Cambodian plain and the sea. To the east, the highlands along the Vietnamese border create another boundary. And these were never fully integrated into the lowland Khmer world and remain home to upland communities, different ways of life. The result is a landscape that's open within, but partially enclosed from the outside. It is inland, river-focused, and seasonal. And this helps explain why Khmer civilization eventually develops around floodplains and water management rather than turning outward toward the sea. But they do have something like a sea. It's just not the ocean. It's called the Tonle Sap, the Great Lake. Calling it a lake doesn't quite capture it. The Tonle Sap is a system. The lake itself, the river that connects it to the Mekong, and the annual reversal of that river's flow. For much of the dry season, the lake remains relatively contained. It's still huge, the largest freshwater body in Southeast Asia, roughly the size of Rhode Island or Luxembourg at its smallest, but it holds those boundaries. And then the monsoon arrives. The Mekong swells with water drawn from across the region, and there's so much water moving through it that it can't drain out into the sea. And so, for a few months each year, the flow reverses. The Tonle Sap River turns and begins pushing water back into the Great Lake. Forests are submerged, fields disappear, central Cambodia becomes a floodplain. The lake expands to around 4 times its dry season size, roughly 12,000 square kilometers, comparable to the size of Connecticut or Northern Ireland. With this expansion comes life. The flood waters carry silt, nutrients, and organic material into the system. When the waters retreat, they leave behind one of the most productive freshwater ecosystems on the planet. The density of fish in the Tonle Sap is among the highest anywhere in the world. Now, this cycle of expansion and contraction has shaped the region for thousands and thousands of years, and it sets a rhythm that the people who live there have to learn to live within. Now, part of that system to the north of the Great Lake is another thing that feeds into the process, and that's Phnom Kulen, a long sandstone plateau that captures rainfall and releases it gradually into the plains nearby, working in concert with the Great Lake. This rhythm shapes what the land can give, and it sets limits at the same time. The dry season, the wet season, the geography, and the climate combine into a set of conditions that the people there have to learn to navigate. These are the civilizational cards that are dealt to the Khmer. A low, flat landscape, a few mountain ranges and hills, a great lake connected to an absolutely massive river. But how does that shape the society that ends up growing there? So who are the Khmer? We need to be a little careful when we talk about the very ancient past with certainty, especially when we bring modern ideas like ethnicity or race into it. But in the most general sense, the Khmer are the people who share the Khmer language and who, for a very long time, have lived within this lower Mekong world. Not a group that suddenly appears at the moment a kingdom is founded or arrives fully formed from somewhere else. People whose roots in this landscape run very deep. And the thing that sits at the center of that deep history, more than anything else, is rice. Human beings have lived in mainland Southeast Asia for tens of thousands of years. But by around 4,000 years ago, wet rice cultivation had become the dominant way of life across the tropical lowlands. And rice does something to a society. It ties people to particular places. It requires cooperation. You can't do it alone. It creates seasonal rhythms of planting, harvesting, and storage that entire communities have to organize themselves around. Long before there are kings or temples or anything we'd recognize as a state, there are villages of people who have learned to live together within a demanding environment shaped by water, weather, and timing, and those habits endure. They are visible in Cambodia today in ways that are still recognizable. One of the ways that historians trace that kind of long continuity is through language. Political systems can change quickly, languages tend to move more slowly. Khmer belongs to one of the oldest language families in mainland Southeast Asia, and it's non-tonal, meaning pitch doesn't change the meaning of a word, unlike Thai, Lao, or Vietnamese. And that might sound like a small detail, but it's actually a marker of just how distinct and deep-rooted this linguistic tradition is. And therefore, so are the Khmer. Now, traditionally, Khmer life has been organized around villages, small settlements strung out along streams, roads, and slightly raised ground. Houses are rectangular and built on wooden stilts to cope with flooding and heat. Extended family sharing the living space above, storage and livestock below. It's a form that's old, functional, and remarkably consistent across a very long stretch of time. Now, spiritual life is just as old and just as tied to the land. The oldest layer is an indigenous animism, a sense that the landscape itself is alive with power. Certain places matter more than others. A grove of trees, a pond, a bend in a river, a village boundary. These are associated with local spirits often called Nyakta, and they're very specific. They're rooted in memory, territory, and community. To recognize a particular spirit is to be from that place, and offerings to them are part of everyday life, a way of maintaining balance and good relations with a living landscape. If you travel around Cambodia today, you'll notice these small shrines everywhere, outside businesses, apartments, pagodas, all across rural areas. These are for kinds of Nyakta, and they receive offerings from the people who belong to that place. It's a very long cultural continuity made visible. When Hindu and Buddhist traditions arrive later, they don't replace this older spiritual world. They settle into it. New religious ideas get added to places that were already considered powerful. Different traditions occupy the same ground because they are understood to be operating within the same landscape of meaning. And then, of course, there is the food. In a floodplain environment, life revolves around rice and fish. Even today in Khmer, the word for eating a meal is the same as the word for cooked rice. It is a cuisine shaped entirely by the environment, and it has remained recognizable over a very long period of time. So when we ask who the Khmer are, we're really describing a constellation of things. A shared language, village life, rice, water, and a spiritual world that understands the landscape as alive. Everything that comes later, towns, kings, temples, monuments, and eventually their modern world, grows out of these basic foundations. And that's the fundamentals of the Khmer. But how do we actually study how that world developed? How those villages and rice paddies and spirit shrines eventually gave rise to one of the great civilizations of the ancient world? That's where it gets a little complicated, because the history of how we understand this period is itself worth knowing about. As Damien Evans and Michael Coe explain in their wonderful book about the history of Angkor, which I highly recommend picking up, for a long time our understanding of this earliest period came from European scholars. And as you'd imagine, they first began trying to make sense of Cambodia's deeper past once the country had become a part of French Indochina. The so-called Classic Angkor period, the name given to the time of the Khmer Empire when the capital of that empire was at Angkor, near modern-day Siem Reap, is usually given a starting date in the early 9th century, 802 CE to be precise. But if we step back and look at everything that comes before it, we're dealing with most of the first millennium of the Common Era, and in some cases a few centuries earlier still, close to 1,000 years. Of social, political, and religious development preceding Angkor's emergence. For many decades, this long pre-Angkorian period was understood through a model which turned out to not be very accurate. The scholars working on this material were, in large part, French, operating within the context of empire. They were dealing with limited evidence and an unfamiliar past, but they also approached it with a few older assumptions about how civilizations were thought to develop. One of the ways they organized this history came from how they understood the region itself. They called it Indochina, the lands between India and China. The label works geographically, and it also carried an implication about cultural formation in their minds. Societies in places like Cambodia were understood in relation to influences arriving from supposedly older, more established centers of civilization, particularly India. They even maintained that Khmer civilization itself was built out of these outside influences. It was a tidy and seemingly intuitive story. Early Cambodian history was framed as a neat progression from Iron Age communities to a sequence of so-called Indianized kingdoms. These were known as the Kingdom of Funan, after which came the Kingdom of Chenla, names derived from Chinese sources, which eventually, over the centuries, led to the Angkor civilization. When scholars use the term Indianized, what they had in mind was a process in which elements from the Indian subcontinent, religious ideas, concepts of kingship, systems of writing, forms of art and architecture, were adopted by local societies, and in doing so, helped give rise to recognizable civilization, state structures, things like that. The implication being that the major forces behind Khmer civilization had actually arrived from elsewhere, rather than developing within. However, we're now in a much better position to actually understand what happened in this pre-Angkorian era, and it's a very different picture. Scholarship now shows that the world inhabited by Khmer-speaking peoples already included large, organized, and connected communities long before any of this. These were not isolated groups. They were participating in long-distance trade networks as far back as the Iron Age, many centuries before Indianization was thought to have produced recognizable kingdoms. The Khmer civilization didn't begin after it was influenced from the outside. It was a collection of societies already in motion. And once scholars began to prioritize sources from within Cambodia itself, another major part of that older model became difficult to sustain. Now, there is no convincing evidence for a unified kingdom called Funan, nor for the one that was presumed to follow it, Chenla. And that's worth pausing on, because a lot of the sources you're likely to come across, the Funan and Chenla model is still presented essentially as fact. It's one of those things that has just stuck around without too much questioning. The reason it held for so long is that early scholars were working almost entirely from Chinese records. And the problem wasn't that those records were totally useless, they actually had a lot of valuable insights in them, but they were written by people far away, describing places they had never been, based on the accounts of traders and envoys. Now, we do get some quite vivid descriptions within them, like the inhabitants of the land engraving ornaments, eating with silver utensils, paying taxes in gold, silver, pearls, and perfumes. We get impressions of rulers riding around on elephant back, and locals entertaining themselves with cockfights or hogfights, living in raised houses on stilts. There's a wooden multi-story pavilion for the king, surrounded by timber walls. In this sense, these records aren't inaccurate, like multiple families sharing a single water source. These are valuable insights. These are features we see even through the Angkor period. These sources give us names, impressions, but it's a sense of exotic courts and distant kings, stories about foreign barbarians in the eyes of the Chinese imperial court at the time. And Evans and co. note that you have to read these sources with an eye for that bias. The Chinese court tended to view the people beyond their borders through a fairly particular lens, and some of the language reflects that. What they don't give you is an accurate picture of how power actually worked on the ground. And when these European historians were looking for kingdoms, progress, the names of kings that they could line up here and there, dynasties of rulers, as they understood them, well, that's what they found, or at least what they supposed they had found in these sources. But it was only when scholars turned to sources from within Cambodia itself, inscriptions, archaeology, a very different picture started to emerge. Not a neat sequence of kingdoms leading to Angkor, but something far more complex, decentralized, and frankly more interesting than that. And that's where we're going next. So if that early picture of the scholarship isn't quite correct, what was actually going on in Cambodia in the centuries before Angkor? What did these societies look like? Well, in the last millennium before the Common Era, particularly during the Iron Age, inland Cambodia was already home to large, organized communities. Not scattered hamlets, archaeology points to sizable clusters of villages with populations sometimes reaching into the thousands, led by local chiefs who exercised real authority over land, movement, and the trade routes that ran through the area. Metals, forest products, rare materials, these were already moving across the landscape long before any overseas trade shows up clearly in the written record, meaning that the region that would become Cambodia was already home to a locally developing group of societies. Then, in the first centuries of the Common Era, the picture shifts slightly. Wider trading networks intensify. Demand from China for luxury goods increases, maritime routes linking East Asia, South Asia, and even the Mediterranean become more active. And Southeast Asia sits right in the middle of all of that. Now, that doesn't mean that suddenly the people living in what we now call Cambodia came together as a unified state. No, it was more like a network of port towns, especially down in the Mekong Delta, what is modern-day southern Vietnam. Places there flourished as points of exchange. Even Roman coins have been found in some of them, while other settlements bloomed further inland across the Great Plain. Goods arriving by sea, moving inland by canal and river, circulating outward again. These places were connected economically and culturally, but again, they weren't a single kingdom. They weren't Funan. Local leadership in these communities was passed down not from father to son, as we might assume, but through the female line, from man to his sister's son. Authority was tied to lineage, land, and a kind of ritual responsibility for the community's relationship to the land and its spirits. It wasn't royal in the way that it would eventually become. It was something older, more local than that. And these weren't marginal communities. They grew enough rice to sustain themselves and then some. Trade brought wealth and prestige. But it wasn't what held these societies together. The land and what it produced was. Over time, some of these local leaders began to accumulate more than others. And by around the 5th century, a number of them started to claim something bigger. Kingship. Now, this is around the time when these earlier scholars called Indianization into the picture. But what we actually see is this wasn't a moment where civilization suddenly arrived from the outside. What we really see is local leaders selectively adopting elements from the Indian subcontinent, names, titles, religious associations, as a way of expressing and reinforcing the power that already existed in their land. Think of it like a family business that's been running successfully for generations. Everyone in the region knows who's in charge, how it works, who you answer to. But then the business starts getting noticed from further afield. Bigger players, wider networks, and suddenly it makes sense to give things a bit more of a formal shape. The old manager becomes the CEO. The handshake agreements become contracts. The operation, still basically the same, but authority is repackaged. The language around it signals something different, something with a bit more recognizableness. So some of these Khmer kings, who were known back then as Pons, began associating themselves with Hindu deities, adding the suffix Varman to their names, meaning protected by, a convention you'll see come up throughout the Angkorian period. Their settlements similarly adopt the suffix Pura, meaning city, announcing that what had been a local centre of power was now something more permanent and deliberately urban. And it is around this time that we can identify the earliest Khmer king with confidence, in the first half of the 6th century. Then, in the early 7th century, there was another major shift. Power began moving inland, away from those delta trading towns and toward the Cambodian basin and beyond. Large-scale rice agriculture became more central to the economy than maritime trade. And with that shift comes another one that's easy to overlook. The way authority was inherited began to change too. And this is actually one of the more surprising things that recent scholarship has turned up. In much of pre-classical Cambodia, political authority wasn't automatically male. Women inherited land, title, and the right to rule, while men often governed through their relationship to those women. There's a queen, Jayadevi, who ruled in the late 7th and early 8th centuries. And this wasn't just symbolic. Real sovereignty passed through her line. She governed independently over a territory encompassing multiple political centres. However, over time, as political power shifts inland and those Hindu-influenced ideas of kingship became more prominent, inheritance increasingly followed the male line instead. And the traces of this earlier system quietly get written out of later genealogies. By the two centuries leading up to 802 AD, the date widely referred to as the beginning of the Khmer Empire, there was still no single Khmer state. There was no Funan that led to Chenla. What there is instead is a landscape of multiple independent polities, each with its own ruler and court. It wasn't just a system of loose chiefdoms, but it was these stratified societies with inherited elites, large populations tied to land and temples, and rulers who were beginning to place themselves within a sacred order that was binding their authority and certain rituals to the place that they inhabited. And that is the world that Angkor will eventually emerge from. But it was the political world that was leading up to Angkor. These clusters of communities, local leaders, a slow shift toward kingship, power moving inland. But to really understand how any of that worked, you have to understand something that ran through all of it, and that continues to run through Cambodian history right up to the modern period, and that's religion. And I don't mean religion in the way we tend to think about it today, something you practice personally or in a congregation. In the ancient Khmer world, religion and political power were essentially the same thing, part of a holistic system. Temples weren't just places of worship, they also had institutional functions, economic, administrative, territorial. Understanding that is probably the single most useful thing you can take into Angkor with you, whether you're visiting or just trying to picture it. So let's look at how that actually worked. The pre-Angkorian religious world was dominated by Hindu gods, particularly Shiva and Vishnu, sometimes fused together in composite forms. Buddhism was present alongside this, with monasteries active across the region. But what matters here is less which gods were being worshipped and more what the temples themselves were doing. Temples were built on places that were already considered sacred, sites already associated with local spirits, the Nyaktar we talked about earlier. By building there, rulers were essentially folding those older powers into the new religious framework, binding the spirits of the land to the gods and to themselves. The temple then became the point where all of that authority converged. And it had very practical consequences. Inscriptions record land, goods, and people being donated to temple foundations. We'll speak about exactly what the word slave might have meant to these foundations in part 3, but essentially, large numbers of commoners were assigned permanently to these institutions, working rice fields, tending animals, cooking, weaving, producing the statues there. Even small shrines collected a form of taxation, whereas larger temple complexes functioned as major economic bodies in their own right. Kings established temples or poured resources into existing ones, and in doing so, they were binding their political authority to religious legitimacy in a form that was really durable. It was literally written in stone. By the late 8th century, the Khmer landscape was already dense with shrines, settlements with moats around them, towns, reservoirs, and canals. All of this had religious functions, as well as the functions of what we might call a proto-state. But it's also worth coming back to the idea of how Indianization came into this, because this picture of how religion actually functioned makes the old model that we used to have look even shakier than it did before. The argument used to be that the Indian influence arrived and essentially civilized Southeast Asia, brought it religion, writing, concepts of kingship, and in doing so, produced these kingdoms. But what we're actually seeing is something much more deliberate and locally driven than that. First of all, there's no actual evidence of what we might call, you know, Indian colonization in any meaningful sense. What took hold were ideas, rituals, texts, and symbols, and they travelled along routes that Southeast Asians were already using, carried by traders and monks, moving through networks that had been active for centuries. And this is perhaps where we see the worldview of the early scholars who constructed this history, just as their empire's civilizing mission had reached what they were calling French Indochina, or perhaps they could legitimize control of the country and its people by saying they had brought civilization to the region, just as the big cultures of South or East Asia had apparently done so more than 1,000 years earlier. But it hadn't really been like that. Long before Hindu or Buddhist ideas reached this part of the world, Southeast Asian communities were already deeply connected, traders moving along the coasts, goods and ideas travelling up and down river networks, communities exchanging across vast distances. As the archaeologist Miriam Stark has shown, these were not isolated societies waiting to be civilized from the outside. When Buddhism and Hinduism arrived, they travelled along routes that already existed, and local rulers didn't simply absorb them, they chose what was useful. Brahmanical ritual gave kings a powerful new language for authority and hierarchy, whereas Buddhism spread more easily through communities and trade networks because it was carried by monks who were travelling the same routes as the merchants. The point is that the Khmer were active participants in this process, not passive recipients of it. Which brings us to the two primary religious traditions themselves, Hinduism and Buddhism. Because to really understand Angkor, you need at least a working sense of what each of them is and what they're doing there. And obviously I'm not going to be able to do either of them full justice here, and I won't try, but I can give you enough to walk around Angkor with and to follow the discussions we'll be having throughout the rest of the series. First, Hinduism. It's worth saying from the outset that Hinduism isn't quite like Western religions, and some people would argue the word itself doesn't really capture what it is. It doesn't have a single founder, a fixed doctrine, or one central text. It's a very old and evolving collection of myths, rituals, and practices that developed over thousands of years. Evans and Co. describe it like a river, meandering, splitting into different channels, but always drawing from the same sources. That's a good way to hold it in mind. There are major story traditions that carry a lot of its ideas. One is the Mahabharata, a vast epic centered on a great war, but really dealing with duty, morality, and the nature of reality. Embedded within it is the Bhagavad Gita, a dialogue between the warrior Arunya and the god Krishna about how to act in the world and how to understand it. Another is the Ramayana, the story of Rama, whose wife Sita is taken away by the demon king Ravana, and who wages a campaign to bring her back. In Cambodia, this story survives in a local form called the Riemke. So these don't remain distant stories, they are absorbed and become part of the Khmer world. The way Hinduism understands time is quite different from Western traditions as well. Time isn't a straight line with a beginning and an end. It moves in these vast cycles. The universe is created, destroyed, and created again, endlessly. And Shiva, one of the central gods, is associated with that destruction and renewal. The same idea extends to individual lives. This is where karma comes in, the accumulated result of your actions across lifetimes, as well as the idea of samsara, the cycle of death and rebirth that those actions keep you within. Now, the goal in this framework is eventually to escape that cycle, and living well within it is guided by Dharma, the moral order of the universe, the balance that holds everything together. Now, all of this feeds directly into how temples are understood. At the center of the Hindu universe is Mount Meru, a mythological mountain, the axis of the cosmos, home of the gods, surrounded by concentric seas and worlds, and a temple is built as a physical representation of that structure. It is, in essence, a model of the universe. The god is present within it in the form of an image that is treated as alive, to be awoken, bathed, fed, and honored. So the rituals aren't just symbolic. It maintains the actual relationship between humans and the divine. And that's essential for understanding what you're going to look at when you walk around Angkor. In terms of the gods themselves, there are three that come up most frequently: Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu. Though in the Khmer world, it's really Shiva and Vishnu who dominate. Shiva is associated with destruction, asceticism, and renewal, and is often represented by a phallic stone form called a linga, associated with generative power. And this becomes a central feature of temple worship. You will see linga all across Angkor. Now, Vishnu is associated with preservation and protection, and appears in different forms when balance in the world needs to be restored. Two of his most important forms are Rama and Krishna. He's also often shown with Garuda, a powerful half-man, half-bird figure you'll see across Angkorian sites as well. Now, these temples are also populated by a whole cast of other figures. If you've seen images of Angkor Wat, you'll have noticed the Apsaras, celestial dancers carved across the walls in their thousands, each one slightly different, their presence signaling abundance and cosmic balance. Alongside them are Devatas, similar in appearance but standing still, facing outward, marking the space as sacred. Now, one of the most famous myths associated with Vishnu is the churning of the sea of milk, a scene carved in extraordinary detail at Angkor Wat, and one we'll come back to in the next episode. But before that, let's get on to the other primary faith of the Khmer, and today it's state religion. Buddhism begins very differently, not with a cosmology or a pantheon of gods, but with a specific human story. Around the 5th century BC, a man named Siddhartha Gautama is born into a small kingdom near what is now the border of Nepal and northern India. He's raised in comfort, largely sheltered from the world. That changes when he leaves his family's estate and encounters what he hadn't been able to see before. Sickness, old age, suffering, death. The realization he had was simple, but it stopped him in his tracks. Wealth and status can't protect you from any of this. He renounced the wealth and comfort of the palace and lived for years as an ascetic. This deliberately harsh and extremely minimalist life, practically starving to death in pursuit of some higher truth. But he eventually concluded that this extreme asceticism isn't the answer either, and he arrived at what he calls the middle path. Not complete withdrawal from the world, and not total indulgence in it, but a careful attention to how the mind actually works. And at around the age of 35, after a long period of meditation, he reached what Buddhism calls enlightenment, and he became the Buddha, the awakened one, and spent the rest of his life teaching others what he had come to understand. At the center of that teaching is a fairly direct observation. Life, as most of us live it, is unstable, unsatisfactory, not necessarily miserable all the time, but never quite holding together the way we want it to. In Buddhist thought, this is called dukkha. The cause of that, the Buddha says, is craving, the tendency to cling to things as if they were permanent when they aren't. And if you can understand that clearly enough, he says you can begin to undo it. This isn't a divine command or a revealed truth. It's presented almost like a diagnosis, with a practical method attached. That method, the Eightfold Path, is a set of guidelines for how to understand, act, speak, and train the mind. Not exactly the Ten Commandments, but some guidelines for living your life. After the Buddha's death, his teachings are preserved by a community of monks and nuns, the Sangha, who dedicate their lives to study, meditation, and ethical discipline. They own no property and depend on almsgiving from the wider community. And in return, supporting them was understood to generate karmic merit for those who do. Over time, Buddhism spreads and diversifies. The branch that eventually becomes dominant in mainland Southeast Asia, including Cambodia, is Theravada Buddhism, which emphasizes monastic discipline and the earliest preserved teachings written in a language called Pali. Another major tradition, Mahayana Buddhism, develops a more expansive universe of figures alongside the historical Buddha, including bodhisattvas. These are beings who are on the path to enlightenment, but delay their own liberation in order to help others. The most important of these in the Khmer world is Avalokiteshvara, also known as Lokeshvara, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. It's worth stressing that Buddhism didn't arrive in Cambodia as a replacement for Hinduism or for the older local spirit traditions. As we've said, for centuries, all of these existed side by side, overlapping, influencing each other, operating at the same sites. Hinduism could even incorporate the Buddha himself as a kind of avatar of Vishnu. And today you will see nectar sites within Buddhist pagodas. Remember, the religious world of Angkor and indeed Cambodia is layered, not sorted into neat categories. But for anyone walking around Angkor today, having even a basic sense of these traditions is good to know, because these beliefs underpin the temples you visit, and therefore, they were inseparable from the economy, the hierarchy, the authority of rulers, and the relationship between the living and the land. All of that is built into the stones, and it's all one big, rich tapestry. And with that foundation in place, we're ready to follow the figure who is traditionally associated with pulling all of these threads together, the man credited with founding the Khmer Empire itself. On a large stone block, about 5 feet tall, is an inscription in Khmer and Sanskrit found at an old Khmer temple site called Stok Kok Tom, now located in modern-day Thailand. Carved across its four sides is a long record commissioned by a prominent family, one that claims a lineage of having supplied a holy man to a succession of Khmer sovereigns stretching back some 250 years. It is one of the most important surviving records from the Angkorian period, and the most coherent narrative source we have for the early centuries of Angkorian kingship. Crucially, it gives us a biographical detail about the king who looms above the apparent beginning of the history of the Khmer Empire, the figure traditionally treated as its founder, Jayavarman II. According to the inscription, Jayavarman came from a place called Java and arrived at a city whose precise location is no longer known. He eventually established himself near modern-day Siem Reap, between the Great Lake and the flat-topped mountain range to the northeast called Phnom Kulen. It was up on that mountain, the inscription says, that a ceremony was performed, one that declared Cambodia free from any outside overlord and proclaimed Jayavarman a universal monarch, a king above all other kings. He later came back down to reign near the lake, and it was there that he died. That's what the inscription says. It's a compelling story, almost legendary, but this source has to be handled carefully. It was written more than 250 years after the events it describes, and it was commissioned, above all, to legitimize the family who paid for it, to place them inside a royal lineage through their priestly connection. At least three other families seem to have attempted something similar in other inscriptions. So while Stok Kok Tom is indispensable, it can't simply be read as a neutral historical account. several of the claims long repeated from it need a closer look. So what do we actually know about Jayavarman II? Where did he come from? Was Cambodia really under the control of Java? And what does Java even mean here? And what did it mean to be a universal monarch? And what was the ceremony on Phnom Kulen really establishing? Was he a lone liberator who founded the Khmer Empire out of nothing? Or was he a regional ruler working within an already established system? One who distinguished himself by extending his authority over more of Cambodia than anyone before him? It's a lot of questions there. So let's start with Java. As we've discussed, in the mid to late 8th century, Cambodia was a patchwork of competing local powers. There wasn't a unified Cambodian state, but there was certainly no clear evidence that whatever this whole country was back then was being dominated by a single foreign power. That's just not there. Now, other interpretations actually take the claim about Java literally, that it was actually the island in modern-day Indonesia that was dominating Cambodia. And they imagined Jayavarman as a captive prince who had been held at the Javanese court and then returned to liberate his homeland. But there's really nothing that would support that narrative, that legend. Later scholars suggested that Java may not refer to the island at all, but to some broader external sphere, perhaps a Javanese-influenced trading world, perhaps the Malay Peninsula. Or maybe it was just a bad translation of Champa, the long-term enemies of the ancient Khmer, long situated in modern-day Middle Vietnam. Now, the jury's still out on some of this, but we can read Java as less a specific place and more of a shorthand for outside authority, a way of saying that whatever foreign influence had been present, Jayavarman was now declaring himself free of it. And what we can say more confidently is that his rise was not a single dramatic moment as captured in this inscription. He didn't just pull the sword from the stone. This was a long process. Scholars have shown that Jayavarman was probably already present in Cambodian lands from around 770 CE, roughly 30 years before the famous ceremony on Phnom Kulen. There's even evidence that he conducted similar ceremonies of proclamation at other sites around the way, which suggests that what happened on Phnom Kulen in 802 might not have been the beginning at all. It might have actually been the final step in a much longer process, a ritual repeated across different centres, each time he was gathering more local rulers into acknowledgement of his supremacy. Now, that makes his rise look less like conquest and more like a slow accumulation of power. Various campaigns, negotiation, alliance building, strategic marriages. This looks like more of an election cycle than simply a run to the finish line. Local rulers were not simply crushed, but brought into a coalition, persuaded through land grants and ritual authority to redirect their allegiance toward this figure who claimed and bargained to stand above them all. He wasn't overthrowing the existing order so much as inserting himself into a new position at the top of it, stitching together older networks of power into something new that he commanded. That was the innovation. He was building something alongside that as well, a circle of trusted figures, priests and administrators, tied directly to him, rather than just to a place, so he could move between centres of power across Cambodia, and this circle would move with him. It was the beginning of something that looks less like a traditional kingdom and more like a personal authority that could travel. And that was precisely the point. That's what makes him stand out. By the later stages of his reign, the effects of this start to show up in various inscriptions. Earlier rulers describe themselves simply as kings in their own right, but in the 9th and 10th centuries, we see new kinds of titles appear. Governors, officials, figures whose authority flows from a position of someone above them. And it was Jayavarman who seems to have started that process. There were local elites that were still governing, but they became part of a hierarchy that recognized a single paramount ruler. And the idea of Cambodia as a single unified realm rather than a loose collection of regions becomes more visible in the language of this period. This is why later generations remember Jayavarman II as the founding figure. Not because he was divine in a literal sense, but because he established something that hadn't existed before. The idea of a king above all other kings. One who answered to no earthly overlord within Cambodia. It's less like someone just becoming president, and more like someone inventing the position of president. Going around convincing people not just that he was the right person for the job, but that the job itself should exist. Which brings us to the ceremony on Phnom Kulen, and to the question at the centre of it. What exactly was the Devaraja? Was this the man who became a god? The word translates roughly as the god who is king, and it has been interpreted in very different ways. Early French scholars took it literally. In their reading, Jayavarman II became a manifestation of the god Shiva on earth. The ceremony marked the moment kingship became explicitly divine. Not just a king above other rulers, but literally a god in human form. Now, other interpretations took a slightly different view. They suggested the Devaraja wasn't Jayavarman himself, but a sacred object. Most likely a stone ritual form, probably a linga, and that had been consecrated as the god who is king. The king's authority was tied to this object, maintained through ritual, and renewed by later rulers when they took the throne. And there's even a small detail in the inscription that people use to support that. It says the Devaraja accompanied Jayavarman when he moved, which implies something physical being carried separate to the king. But neither of these interpretations has fully held up over time. Modern scholarship has moved away from the idea of a literal god-king, and there's no clear evidence for a single, enduring, sacred object functioning in the way earlier scholars imagined. What scholars like Evans and Co. suggest is something more grounded. The ceremony established a royal cult centered on a protective power, one that drew on both the Hindu traditions we've discussed and on much older local beliefs, the Nikta, the spirits tied to the land itself. In this reading, the god who is king isn't describing Jayavarman at all. It may be describing a supreme spiritual authority, one that sits above all others in the landscape, and now the king was aligned to it. The ritual, in other words, is more like a contract than a literal divine transformation. So the idea of the god-king, so thoroughly subscribed to, and a phrase I myself will still often reach for when describing later events or people in the series, well, it might not be exactly what you have thought. Basically, it meant that this was a king who was ruling without earthly overlords, more like this spiritual force's representative, not a literal embodiment of the god. Kind of like the custodian of the relationship between the realm and this supreme protective force. And what about the famed importance of the ceremony itself? Well, there's also a good chance that the significance of this ceremony was amplified over time, built up by later rulers who had an interest in tying their own authority back to this foundational moment. Which means that even here, we're dealing with something shaped as much by later memory as by what actually happened on that mountain. Remember, the Stok Kak Tom inscription, where almost all of this is derived from, was written a quarter of a millennium after the events it described. But we should also be a little careful of going completely overboard and saying that Jayavarman II was just some guy. None of this totally diminishes his importance, but it simply places him within a larger, evolving picture, rather than the idea of this one man having changed things so single-handedly. A great man idea of history that is really the whole story. He didn't create the Khmer Empire out of nothing. The foundations had been developing for centuries, and will be developed further after his rule. But what he did was preside over the moment where it seems that the threads were woven together, and he found a way to extend authority across more of Cambodia than anyone before him, establishing the political and ceremonial framework that would make Angkor possible and begin building toward its foundations. the city of Mahendrapavata on Phnom Kulen and Jayavarman's later settlement at Hariharalara stand as the material evidence of everything the Khmer had been building toward. And it's to Mahendrapavata that we turn first. If you've been to Angkor and climbed Phnom Bakeng, the temple on the hill just outside the gates of Angkor Thom, not far north of Angkor Wat, you'll know the view from the top. And if you were to look out to the northeast from up there, you'll see a long, flat mountain range rising in the distance, steep on all sides with a broad plateau on top. That's Phnom Kulen. Up there are waterfalls, streams and drainage systems that feed the rivers around Siem Reap. And the view from the top looking back down over the land is breathtaking. You can't help but feel something of what a king standing up there must have felt. It's an incredible part of the country. But it's a very different landscape from the flood plains below. The soil is thin, the air is cooler and more humid. It is not an easy place to grow rice at scale. For a long time, that was essentially all that could be said about it from a historical standpoint. But scholars felt there must be more up there. Early explorers had found scattered temple remains on the southeastern side of the plateau, but not much else. Phnom Kulen was assumed to be the location of Jayavarman's city of Mahendrapavata, but it looked like little more than a handful of ruins swallowed by the jungle. Even into the mid-20th century, researchers mapping dams and irrigation systems still couldn't see how a functioning city could have existed up there. And then there was the more recent problems. For decades, this area was simply too dangerous to explore properly. The Khmer Rouge were present on Phnom Kulen well into the 1990s. It was one of their last strongholds, which meant that even as Cambodia began to open up, the mountain remained largely off limits. The history was there, buried under the canopy, but nobody could get to it. Thankfully, that changed with time, peace, and a remarkable piece of technology. Using aerial laser scanning that can cut through dense forest canopy and map what lies beneath, a method known as LIDAR, archaeologists began to see what no one had been able to see from the ground. And what emerged was not a handful of scattered ruins. They found the outline of a planned royal city, a central temple, a palace, an organized urban space built deliberately around them. This was the first capital of the Khmer Empire, Mahendrapavata. The scans revealed long straight lines cut across the plateau, running north to south and east to west, some stretching 10 to 15 kilometres. Together they form a grid covering 40 to 50 square kilometres, dividing the landscape into distinct zones. And these lines of construction were structural, highlighting reservoirs, dams, temple enclosures, neighbourhood boundaries, and the royal palace itself. All of it aligning with or connecting into this grid. Smaller causeways linked temples and ponds to these main axes. Some lines terminate deliberately at significant points like a temple or a water feature, anchoring the whole system in place. It was a fully planned city. And it was the late, great Damien Evans whose work on Angkor using this technology was extraordinary and whose loss to the field was immense. He and his team showed that this was far more than the site of a single ceremony. The temple where the Devaraja ritual most likely took place, Rongchen, lines up precisely with the centre of a vast rectangular reservoir, an attempt to reshape an entire natural valley by cutting into the bedrock and defining its edges with huge earthen walls. The reservoir would have held more than 30 hectares of water, and it sits squarely within the wider layout of the city. It was never finished, however. But the ambition is kind of the point. Even here, on a mountaintop, the earliest Angkorian rulers were already thinking in terms of monumental water engineering. This was the experiment. The grid, the reservoirs, the alignment of sacred and civic space. It was a new kind of city for the Khmer world, and it was being worked out for the first time up on that plateau. At the southern edge, channels carried water carefully down toward the plains below. Vast quarries were created in this area, and quite remarkably given the distance, this is actually where all of the sandstone that would eventually be used to build the great temples of Angkor over the next few hundred years was quarried and floated down from. So the mountain continued to be a sacred place long after it stopped being the capital. Its streams were blessed by religious images that were carved directly into the riverbeds. So why did Jayavarman leave? Well, the honest answer is that the mountain couldn't sustain what he was building. The thinking was there, the ambition was there, but the land couldn't support it. The soils were too thin for large-scale rice cultivation, the terrain too uneven. There was only so much population the plateau could feed, and only so much a city built up there could anchor in any lasting way. It was a great stage for the new king, but didn't have the foundations to be much else. Water was already understood as the key to everything, the means by which a ruler could feed a population, concentrate labour, and build on a truly monumental scale. But to make that work, you needed the right landscape, and Phnom Kulen was just not it. So Jayavarman moved his court down to what would become Hariharalaya, which translates roughly as the abode of Harihara, Harihara being the composite deity, a fusion of Shiva and Vishnu, the destroyer and the preserver combined into a single form. It's a name that tells you something about how this king understood his own role, holding these great traditions together, sitting at the point where different sources of divine power were converging. Now, if you visit the Rulos group of temples southeast of Siem Reap today, you're standing in what remains of that settlement. Here, the landscape offered everything the mountain couldn't. Seasonal floods replenished the soil. Rice cultivation could expand across wide, flat tracts of land. Populations could grow. Surpluses could accumulate. And the relationship between water, agriculture, and power could finally operate at the scale he'd been imagining. He was now at the agricultural and demographic heart of Cambodia, in a location that later generations would come to see as the nucleus of the Angkorian state. Jayavarman II likely spent his final years there. He probably died sometime around 835 CE and was succeeded by his son, who maintained the court and continued the lineage he had established. Mahendrapavata and Hariharalaya mark two distinct phases of the same process. One, exploratory, working out the ideas, testing the ambition on a mountaintop. And the other, consolidating that, bringing those ideas down to a landscape that could sustain them. Together, they form the hinge between the pre-Angkorian world and the upcoming Angkorian one. Jayavarman II didn't conjure Angkor fully formed by himself. What he did was pull together a fragmented political landscape, establish a new kind of authority, and set in motion an urban and political experiment that would unfold over the generations that followed. The techniques, the thinking, the ceremonial framework, all of it was now in place. And his successors would take it from there. Building on the floodplains near the Tonle Sap, where water, agriculture, population, and power could be brought together at a scale that would produce something the world just hadn't seen at that point. The temples, reservoirs, roads, the population, the monumental world of Angkor. And that is what we will see in the next episode.